I've got Dr. Eric Carlsrud, professor of geography at California State University, is my co-host tonight from Stanislaus, where he has taught physical and environmental geography since 1990, and his research interests in the fields of geomorphology, soils, climatology, and the study of past climates. Professor Carlson received his bachelor's degree at Northern Arizona University, his master's degree at the University of Wyoming, and his PhD at the University of Calgary in Alberta, Canada. Dr. Carlstrom maintains a website on this topic, http://naturalclimatechange.googlepages.com/home. And I was going to, and our guest this evening is Dr. Timothy Ball. And Eric, did you want to go ahead and introduce him for us?
Yeah, sure. Melody, you're coming in very quietly, so if you could speak up a little bit, I would appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's better. Okay, yeah, we're very happy to have Dr. Timothy Ball return for an interview with us. We interviewed, Melody and I interviewed Dr. Tim Ball last May, I believe. Dr. Tim Ball has gained some notoriety. You can even look him up on Wikipedia now. He is Canada's first climatology PhD. He got his bachelor's from the University of Winnipeg, his master's from the University of Manitoba in 1970 in geography, and his PhD in climatology from the University of London, England in 1983. And his dissertation was on the historical weather records from Canada's north. So he put in a career teaching University of Winnipeg from 1973 to 1996, finishing there as a professor in 1996. Dr. Tim Ball has, as I say, received some notoriety because he has been a climate skeptic, is what he's sometimes called, or a climate change denier, both of which we determined were fairly ironic descriptions of him, since he's been trying to educate people about the realities of climate change for his entire career. Before we launch into this interview, I just again would repeat that I have put together a little website on climate change in which I have written a summary of our past interview with Dr. Tim Ball, as well as and links to Melody's archives are on that site, as well as other materials I put together. And again, that website is http://naturalclimatechange.googlepages.com/home. So, Dr. Tim Ball, welcome back to our show, Truth Quest with Melody, and certainly glad that you could come back and perhaps try to extend some of the conversation that we had last time. Last time we covered a whole series of topics, both scientific and political, and since this has become such a political and now economic issue, when we talk in terms of cap and trade and carbon sequestration, it's important, I think, for us to distinguish what the scientific aspects of the subject are and what the political aspects are. Just to launch this thing off, last time we talked about some of the upcoming conferences, like a big conference in Copenhagen, an international conference that was going to discuss kind of a Kyoto Protocol kind of thing. Could you bring us up to date as to what is happening politically, perhaps, first, and then we can get into the science?
May I do just one thing here? I wanted to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I also want to extend my welcome back and your patience to our program. Thank you, Dr. Ball. So, Dr. Ball, would you like to go ahead and begin?
Well, I was very appreciative of the opportunity to talk about some things last time, and there's a whole lot more to talk about and many issues, and I think one of the things that's changing, and I did a radio program this morning here locally, and when I started doing them about 4 years ago, the total anger and every call was hostile, and now none of those. In fact, people phoning in with very, very good questions. So there's a whole shift in the public understanding of this issue, and they're feeling less and less bullied and less intimidated, and of course they're starting to ask questions about the science. And of course, then beyond that, the questions about why have we been sold this misleading information? What's the motive behind this? And that's the political aspect of it. But I think it's healthier if we can keep those two as much apart as possible, and then help people to understand the science of it, or how little we know, and then possibly lead that into the political exploitation of the issue.
In that vein, Dr. Ball, could you fill us in as to some of the latest political developments, say, in the cap and trade legislation, which has been wending its way through at least the U.S. Congress and perhaps some of the others as well?
Okay, the cap and trade, and of course, just to remind everybody that this is another of those examples of what I call moving the goalposts, and they do that by changing the name. It was originally, of course, the carbon credits that evolved from the Kyoto Accord, and the carbon credits evolved in Kyoto as an attempt to get the U.S. to sign the Kyoto Accord. What happened was the U.S. were not interested in signing, and mostly the European countries said, what would you want in order to sign? And they said, well, look, give us some credits for the carbon we're taking out of the air now, particularly through forestry and agriculture. And in fact, humans of all of the CO2 we put into the atmosphere, and it's a very small amount relative to the natural amounts, but we recover 50% each year with our forests and agriculture. And so what they wanted was credit for that. Kyoto, of course, essentially died. The only reason it got passed was because Russia signed on to it. And that's an interesting story in itself. I heard a wonderful presentation by Ilarionov, who was the sort of climate change and economic advisor to Putin here in Vancouver, very, very accurate scientifically, and he said, no, we're not going to sign. There's no scientific support for this. And then the next thing we knew was Putin was signing. It turned out that Putin was told by the Europeans if he didn't sign that they wouldn't support Russia's application to the World Trade Organization, and I guess they decided that was a much bigger plum than the $2 billion in carbon credits they might get. But so the carbon credits idea didn't die. Where it ended up in the White House in a meeting between Al Gore, Vice President then, Bill Clinton, the President, and Ken Lay of Enron, and Lord Brown, who was the head of British Petroleum. And they then set about setting up this whole carbon trading scheme. It really didn't go very far for a while, but then it's been brought back now under the new name, but it's the same old scheme of cap and trade. And it as people look at it and where it's been tried, it's failed. And as you said, it's been approved by the House, but it doesn't look like it will get through the Senate, no more than the Kyoto Accord got through the Senate, because it was voted against 95-0 the last time. And of course, along with that is the upcoming World Climate Conference in Copenhagen, and where they're really under pressure to come up with something to replace Kyoto, because Kyoto expires in 2012 unless something is done. So there's increasing use of scare ideas, ocean acidification, and just a steady stream of issues that are simply not really valid issues at all, but they add to the concern for the public. And so that's about where we are now, but it doesn't look like cap and trade is going to go through, and it doesn't look like the Copenhagen is going to be successful, because both India and China have said, we're simply not interested. And one of the things that's interesting is that, of course, the people pushing the global warming have always had the moral high ground. Oh, we're saving the planet, we care about the planet and the children and so on. Well, now India has come out and said, well, yeah, okay, this minor increase in temperature predicting in the next 100 years, but we've got people starving to death right now, and that's a much more pressing issue for us. So they kind of trumped that moral high ground issue, and that's essentially the state of the political situation right now. And of course, the other thing that's happening, Eric, is that the committees are meeting to prepare the next assessment report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And of course, that is the, in quotes, the official source of climate data. And they're preparing for that right now. And so we'll see the fifth report, AR5, in the next couple of years.
So can if I'm following you correctly here? So, because
yeah.
I was the way things are going in other legislation and media, I was under the impression that all this was going through. And so it kind of sets us up for a false flag event in a sense. If they can't get this through, and they're bound and determined to do it.
Yep. And of course, it's like so many of these plans. And one of the things that we get to the political side of it, but you know. If what was being proposed in all of the issues was genuine change, something, a completely new way of doing things, and of course you get the old thing about there's nothing new under the sun, but many of these schemes like the cap and trade, carbon taxes, green jobs, and all of these other factors have been tried in other countries, and they have been found beyond wanting. They have basically failed. And you see countries like Britain, for example, which allowed its nuclear plants to deteriorate, and no replacement plans, and they've shut down their coal, and they went to wind power, and they're going to be in desperate energy needs for at least the next 40 years. And I look here in Canada, that the province of Ontario, the same situation. And so, as I say, these plans are simply failing.
Wow.
Yeah, if I could just backpedal a little bit here and kind of give the Al Gore side of things that he would have put forth in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, which, of course, won him an Academy Award. And as you said last time, he should get an Academy Award because it's great fiction and propaganda. But he also got a Nobel Peace Prize for that. But the scenario that he puts forth is, of course, that humans burning fossil fuels over the last 150 years or so have caused a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in the average temperature of the Earth, and that this could lead to positive feedbacks, which would cause runaway global warming that could, of course, melt the polar ice caps and cause radical changes in sea level rise. Could cause infectious diseases to spread uncontrollably, from this scenario, this kind of gloom and doom scenario, we have to save the world, and it would appear that he's right in step with what you say, the IPCC, which is the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, as you say, has put out 4 assessment reports and is bound next now to put out another one. But these have become very, very very politicized, and in fact are not credible science at all. Could you speak a little bit about that process as you've seen it, just to kind of, again, just set the stage for this debate here?
Before we go too far, is there any way that you can turn your phone down just a tad, Dr. Ball?
Yes, I can, sure.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I'm coming to. Is that better? I'll talk a little quieter, too.
I think I've finally.
I get so excited about these things. I raise the level of my voice. And,
yeah. Well, I have something rare. I actually have a board tech here that's trying to work with me on the sound levels, and so that's really helping because I'd like to kind of improve that part. So,
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. A couple of things, of course, with this. Just a brief comment about Gore's movie. The CO2 and human production of it, and therefore the levels in the atmosphere are going to continue to increase. That idea is almost completely discredited now, partly because the records show, and every record of any duration of any time period shows that temperature changes before CO2. In other words, CO2 is not driving temperature. The second problem is that is what I call the black paint effect, and that is that if you want to block the sunlight coming through a window, you put a coat of black paint on, and that will reduce almost all the light coming through. Well, the CO2 in the atmosphere at the current level is essentially trapping or delaying the escape of heat almost to its maximum. So even if we add a second coat of paint or a third coat of paint, it doesn't reduce the amount of sunlight coming through the window by that much. And the same thing is true if we double or triple CO2 in the atmosphere. The effect is far, far less. And in order to get around that problem, what the IPCC did was they said, oh, well, there's this positive feedback. Now, what they mean by that is they say, well, oh, CO2 causes the temperature to increase. Well, we now know that's not true, but they say, let's assume that's the case. And then when the temperature increases, that means there'll be more evaporation, therefore more water vapor in the atmosphere, and water vapor, as a greenhouse gas, will therefore enhance or continue to cause the temperature to increase in this positive feedback mechanism. Now, Richard Lindzen, Roy Spencer, and other scientists have shown that that's simply not the case, that positive feedback is simply not tenable under the scientific way it's presented. So the whole premise of Gore's movie and the whole premise of global warming due to humans, which is CO2, as time has gone on, it's just gradually been shown to be simply a false theory. And but of course, one of the things that happened in the middle of all of this was that the whole issue became politicized, and of course Gore took it to the ultimate with his movie. The IPCC evolved, and it was formed in Villach, Austria in 1988, and it evolved out of the United Nations Environment Program, UNEP. Now, UNEP was the brainchild of Maurice Strong, who's currently living in China and just celebrated his 80th birthday. But he made the statement over 30 years ago that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And of course, if you think about that, how would you go about that? I mean, it's a measure of the ambition of the man, and he's incredibly persuasive. I've talked to people that have worked with him or for him. How would you go about shutting down an industrialized nation? Well, if you take the nation as the analogy of a car, and it's a good one because we are essentially a fossil-based engine, you can shut the engine down by squeezing the fuel line, but if you do that, the public will react immediately, and the recent increase in fuel prices is a good example of that. But you can also stop the engine by plugging the exhaust. And if you could show that the exhaust from those industrialized nations, that is, what was the byproduct of burning the fossil fuels, was destroying the planet, then you could effectively shut the nation down. That's why CO2 became the focus, even though it's such a minuscule part of the total climate system. It's not even a major part of the greenhouse gases. It's less than 4%. But that's why it became the focus. And in order to keep the focus on that, when the IPCC was formed, they took the definition of climate change that was already set out by the United Nations Environment Program as being those climate changes caused by humans. In other words, in the terms of reference that they have, what they can look at and how they look at it was predetermined. Now, Melody, I can relate this because I served on commissions of inquiry and chaired commissions of inquiry. They're wonderful vehicles for politicians. And because they can say, well, okay, there's a problem, we'll have a commission, independent commission of inquiry, look at it. They control the commissions of inquiry by the terms of reference that they write. And just as a good example, with the Warren Commission inquiry into Kennedy shooting, and I remember Warren being asked about a particular aspect, and he said, well, that wasn't in my terms of reference. And I've experienced this. In fact, the very first inquiry I was chair of, I had to go back to the minister and say, look, Mr. Minister, I can't possibly determine what's gone on here with these terms of reference. But, of course, that was precisely what they wanted. And so when Strong wrote the terms of reference for the IPCC, he limited it by the definition of climate change, and then he further controlled it by setting up something called the summary for policymakers. And what's interesting is in the science portion of the IPCC, they say, do not use this for policymaking. And yet, they have this summary for policymakers. It's a separate group, mostly of politicians and bureaucrats, who sit down and write the summary. And that is released to the public ahead of the scientific report from the technical group, what's called Working Group 1, before it's released. And what happens is that the summary then goes back to the scientists with the advisory that makes sure that your science report agrees with our summary. And so by this process, of course, they control both the science input into those reports, but also the political control is there. And, of course, that's one of Maurice Strong's great strengths, was understanding how bureaucracies work and how to control them. And so that's why we end up with the IPCC focusing almost exclusively on CO2 and then only on human causes of climate change. And, of course, the bottom line is unless you understand how much climate change is naturally and what those causes are, you can't possibly separate out or identify what effect humans are having.
Well, last time we talked, Tim, you mentioned that Maurice Strong himself stopped his education after grade 9. So here is with essentially a ninth grade education who has, by writing these terms of reference, essentially handcuffed an entire science for, what, at least two or three decades now. And billions, tens of billions, perhaps even hundreds of billions of dollars now of government monies, not just the United States, but other governments as well, have gone towards this kind of research, but has been focused in this way towards human influences on climate change, but not researching natural climate change, which is, if you'll excuse the term, pretty back-asswards, I would, from a scientific point of view.
But the thing, Eric, is that what they've effectively done is to block the scientific method. And as you know, the scientific method works by a theory being proposed based upon certain assumptions, and then other scientists will challenge and test that theory. You don't try to prove a theory, which of course is what's going on now with the IPCC. You try to disprove it. It's what Popper called falsibility, and they effectively blocked that because when scientists like myself and Richard Lindzen started to ask questions and say, well, hold on a minute, we've got problems with it. Oh, we were immediately isolated and silenced. Oh, they're paid by the oil companies and so on. But sorry, you're going to say
something. This sounds a little pathological or psych.
Sociopathic.
Yes. Yeah. Because this guy is assuming that you're not going to ask questions. What did he think that he was going to have when you did to control the rest of the scientists?
Well, when he was asked about that, and the listeners can read a book called Cloak of Green, This is a book by a Canadian reporter by the name of Elaine Dewar. And what she wanted to do was to write a book praising the environmentalists in Canada, including Maurice Strong. And she started doing her research, and as any good reporter and any good student should do, you set a hypothesis, and then you go and do the research, and you have to keep an open mind that if you find that your hypothesis is not supported, then you must report what's called the null hypothesis. Now, what Elaine Dewar found was the more she dug into what these people were doing, that she found them as corrupt, if not more corrupt, than the corporations they were attacking and the whole industries they wanted to bring down. And when she asked Maurice Strong, she said, well, look, if you wanted to shut down the industrialized nations and make all these political changes, why didn't you run for political office? And his response was, you cannot do anything as a politician. But he then added, I'm going to go to the United Nations where I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. And, of course, this is the measure of the cleverness of the man, because that's precisely what he did. And through the IPCC, focused the whole world's attention on their reports and on CO2.
Now, before we leave this topic, Tim, you mentioned the terms of reference for the IPCC. I presume there's a document that has these terms of reference. Is this something we could look and find?
Yes, you can go to the history of the IPCC. It's just simply www.ipcc.com, and of course they have all of the documents there, including these original terms of reference, and some of it also is in the United Nations Environment Program. So of course this is what's interesting, is that all the information is there. It's just you've got to be able to dig it out and then understand what they're actually saying.
Yeah, and so they have really controlled the direction of the research through their control of funding, through their control of putting in editors in journals that are sympathetic with their worldview, and through bureaucratic kind of strong arm tactics, I guess.
Yes, and one of the interesting things was that if you recall, Eric, there was that famous graph called the hockey stick.
Yes.
And this was done by Michael Mann and Bradley and Hughes, MBH 98 as it's sometimes referred to. And it showed that virtually no temperature change for the last 1,000 years, and then a sudden dramatic turn up in the 20th century, therefore simulating the shape of a hockey stick. And that graph appears 5 times in the summary for policymakers of the 2001 report. Steve McIntyre and Ross McKittrick carried out a very standard scientific test of reproducible results. That is, you take the data and the methodology that what some other researchers done, and you try to reproduce it. And if you can't, then there are obviously some questions that need to be asked. And when McIntyre and McKittrick did this, of course, they found that they couldn't reproduce the results. And the key thing in that was what was called the medieval warm period. And of course, you see, they're saying, no, that the 20th century is the warmest ever. But I knew from all the research I had done that it was much warmer 1,000 years ago through this medieval warm period than it is today. And there's a very famous email from that Professor Deming received he published an article somebody thought he was part of this climate science group, and he got this email saying, you know, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period. Well, of course, the hockey stick achieved that. And so anyway, there was a big conflict between what McIntyre and McKittrick were saying and what Mann was saying. And so the National Academy of Sciences ordered a separate report by a Professor Wegman to investigate the validity of the both sides of the argument. In the most amazing thing that I've ever seen in my time in science, he actually, in his report, identified a group of 43 climate scientists who he said that, you know, there was a huge conflict of interest because they had all co-authored articles together. And he also implied that they were peer reviewing each other's work. And of course that's why peer review became such a big issue. Oh, well, you haven't got peer reviewed publications. And as you mentioned, Eric, it became almost impossible because the editors of the journals were sympathetic, and so you ended up with an enormous bias against anybody that dared to question that hypothesis. So that was another way that they blocked the normal scientific method of trying to disprove the theory.
One of the things, Tim, that is kind of striking and notable about this this climate research program that has been developed mainly since the 80s through the 90s and up till the present, with lots and lots of federal funding. I think in the U.S. Yep. it's somewhere upwards of $4 to $6 billion now per year. The research is based primarily on computer models,
yes.
That you call general circulation models, or GCMs.
Right.
And as you said in our last interview, these little research groups are so incestuous that they'll take the output from one computer model and use that as an input for the next computer model. Well, when I went to graduate school back in the late 70s and 80s in Calgary, Alberta, there was a phrase amongst my fellow graduate students called GIGO, or GIGO,
yep, yep.
Which is, when we're dealing with computers, garbage in, garbage out. If the conclusions can be no better than the assumptions and the data which are fed into the computer model. And so could you speak a little bit about the problems with basing scientific projections into, now understand the science of chaos,
yeah,
comes out of meteorology. Meteorology, the weather has chaotic behavior, so it's impossible for us to predict weather for more than 5 or 10 days. No weatherman,
yep,
can do that. And
right,
yet these people are saying they can project what the temperature is going to be in 100 years or 50 years. Could you comment on some of the problems with that?
Yeah, well, one of the best, for the layperson, one of the best explanations of all of this is in Ross McKittrick. I just mentioned him earlier with McIntyre, but with a climate scientist who I've known for 30 years named Christopher Essex. And Essex and McKittrick wrote a book called Taken by Storm, and there's a very, very good understandable analysis of the problems with the computer models. Now, we had numerical modeling as early as the 1950s, but they were grossly simplistic. But it wasn't until about 1972 that the computers became a little more sophisticated and started to be used for forecasting through input of data and then simple linear trends. And one of the places where this was first used and became severely problematic was in something that the Club of Rome produced called Limits to Growth. And these were projections of the way that resources were going to be used and the way the economies were going to expand, but also forecasting massive increases in global population and so on. So the computer models became a very, very useful tool, and they're still extremely useful because you can handle vast amounts of data in them, but of course, as you said, you have to understand what you're putting in and understand, therefore, what you're going to get out of them. Now, in climate science, the computer models really started with a Japanese fellow who came over to the U.S. by the name of Manabe, M-A-N-A-B-E, in about 1982 was his first really significant model. And it's interesting to look at that one because already by that date, they were assuming that CO2 was going to double and that it was really the important variable. And of course, that ties itself in with the 1988 formation of IPCC and the computer models they use. But the computer models, there are so many problems. Well, let me start with this general statement. When you use computer models, there is a scientific responsibility. And that, in my opinion, with the computer models is for the most part not being met. But when you take the product of your models, the output of your models, and take that into the public arena and use it for forecasting, then a whole social responsibility kicks in. And I think one of the most incredible statements so far in this new 21st century was when Alan Greenspan appeared before Henry Waxman's committee and said, you know, my computer models were wrong. And it was such a bland statement as only Greenspan could make. And then somebody said, well, how long have you been using these models? Well, 40 years. You know, I mean, you put the whole economy into a tailspin with this. Well, the same is true of these computer climate models. Now, as you point out, everybody knows they can't forecast accurately beyond, well, five days, maximum 10, they're claiming in Reading, England with the medium-term models. But weather, the meteorology of the atmosphere is essentially nonlinear. In other words, that's the chaos part that you're referring to. And yet the models are built on a linear basis. So in other words, the models are linear, but the actual weather itself is nonlinear. So there's an immediate problem right there. And then when people started to point out, well, you're saying you know what's going to happen 100 years from now, and yet you can't tell me 5 days, they came back with the argument that, oh, well, there's a difference between a weather model and a climate model. Because weather is what's going on right now, and they acknowledge that that is nonlinear. But the climate is the average of the weather. And therefore, it is possible to make climate predictions over those longer periods of time. Now, the fallacy of that for me is, of course, that the climate is derived from the weather. And if you don't know what the weather is, you can't possibly determine the climate. And so it becomes a sort of almost a nonlinear argument. But that's where the problem is with these climate models and why they're claiming they can make these 100-year predictions. When in fact they can't. Now, beyond that, Eric, is that your model, and people need to understand these are not physical models like you did, you know, in your high school science project with a volcano and stuff spewing out the top of it. These are actually mathematical models of the atmospheric system. And they divide the globe up into rectangles. And in the early days, these were huge rectangles of 4 degrees of latitude and 5 degrees of longitude and so on. They've refined that down now to smaller rectangles. But we don't have data for the whole globe. And when you start looking at the historic data, I mean, 70% of the world's oceans, we've got no historic climate data at all. And so the question becomes, what data have you built the model on? And the answer is virtually nothing. And they do something called parameterization, which is basically, you know, a very, very crude guess of what's going on within each rectangle. And so what the model's built on, and then the problem's exacerbated because those rectangles I've talked about are at the surface. But you start moving up above the surface, we've got even less data. I mean, temperatures going up through to the top of the atmosphere. I mean, we've been doing balloon sounding for maybe 30, 40 years at the most. But beyond that, we've got nothing. And so how do you create this three-dimensional model when you've got no surface or very little surface data and you've got virtually nothing above the surface, and yet that's how these models are created? So from the very fundamentals, that they simply can't work.
Dr. Ball, we did a interview with Rosalind Peterson, and one of the things that really stuck out for me was the fact that I guess what I want to ask you is, where are you on man controlling the weather or having an involvement in the control of weather?
Okay, that's the general term for that is called geoengineering.
Right.
And it's been around for some time. I mean, if you want to get really historical about it, rain dancing is an attempt to control the weather. And of course, what's interesting to me too is that the major advances that the anthropologists talk about in human history are attempts to control the weather. Fire, for example, provides you with a microclimate where you can, allows you to live in an area you wouldn't normally be able to live in. And of course, clothing is another part of that. You create your own microclimate. The third one, which was introduced 9,000 years ago in what is now Iraq, was irrigation. Attempt to control precipitation. So those are forms of geoengineering. But in the modern sense of it, those are passive. You're not attempting to change the weather. You're simply trying to control a very small area of it around your own backyard, if you want. But, of course, when we start talking about geoengineering today, we're talking about active control of weather. And I remember back when cooling was the trend in 1970s, and there were all sorts of proposals to stop the cooling trend that was going on. For example, the Soviets proposed building a dam across the Bering Straits and to block the cold Arctic waters flowing out into the North Pacific, which would then warm up right around the globe, that latitude, which would make things warmer in the Soviet Union. And there were other schemes about putting great reflectors in space to direct sunlight onto northern cities to add more heat energy and so on. So the ideas of geoengineering have been around for some time. More recently, the scary ones, and there has been an experiment done, very few people know about this, where they sprinkled iron filings across quite a large area of the Pacific Ocean. And this was an attempt to increase the absorption of CO2 by the sea. Just recently they announced that it was a total failure. What bothered me about it was that I never saw any concern about how that would change the chemistry of the surface water and that what that would do to phytoplankton and all the rest of it. We've seen the president's advisor, Mr. Chu, and Holdren and these people making proposals for geoengineering. But the bottom line is if you don't know how mechanisms work and what's going on, you're better to do nothing. Because imagine, let's say CO2 was the problem. Would the proposal have been back when it was cooling to add more CO2 to the atmosphere? You might do exactly the wrong thing. And so that's really my take on the whole geoengineering situation.
Well, from what it looked like to me is that she was had forwarded on a mini graphs of NOAA from NOAA that were projects of weather control in various parts of the country, and it looked like there was quite a few of them. I mean, and you start looking at, well, if they're doing this around in this area, can you imagine if this technology spreads around the globe, then we would have an effect on global warming, possibly.
Well,
and,
sorry, well, the problem is
If I could I was there for that interview too, and what Rosalind Peterson said, and she has a website, I think CaliforniaSkyWatch.org or something like that. She has done a lot of research on this and asked specific questions to NASA and read some of their reports, and NASA does, according to her, admit the presence of persistent contrails, which many would call chemtrails, that can last for 12 hours or more. And NASA admits that that these persisting contrails can form artificial clouds at high in the atmosphere, which in fact mimic, say, cirrus clouds, and would therefore trap heat in the atmosphere and may in fact cause a little bit of global warming. And so maybe that's what Melody is talking about.
Yeah, and certainly one of the things we talked about before, and the difficulty with the climate models is they can't simulate clouds, but we do know that high cloud, like the cirrus, function very differently than the low clouds, like the stratus layers. But this chemtrail thing is generally been going on under a project called HARP, which is the High Altitude Research Project. And that started again back in the 60s. And it was at that time it was an attempt to get a better understanding of the ionosphere and what's called the F layer. But at that time it was about transmitting radio signals around the world. Now that, of course, has deteriorated with the satellites. But you see, NASA also has the concern that somebody's going to point the finger at them, as these chemtrail things are sort of doing, because, and here's the point, Eric and Melody. I, for a long time, have raised the fact that so many commercial aircraft flights, especially in the winter time in the Northern Hemisphere, are actually in the lower stratosphere. And now, when they put their exhausts out, and it's mostly water vapor, but there are other particulates in it, when they put them out into the troposphere, the percentage that they put out as a function of the percentage of gases is actually very, very small. But once you get into the much, much thinner atmosphere of the stratosphere, then these injections of material become much more significant. And certainly NASA has been very concerned about that with the exhaust from their rocket launches and from their vehicles in space. Now, I teased a couple of the NASA scientists one time by saying, well, you don't have to worry because you got so much debris up there, it'll block the sunlight anyway and cool things down. But that certainly is a major concern for NASA. Now, there is one interesting aspect of this from a climate point of view. There is a relatively rare cloud form called noctilucent clouds. Now, that's Latin for night, nocti, and lucent, which means light. And so they mean nightlight clouds. They're visible very high in the atmosphere at sunrise or sunset, and I have some wonderful pictures of them. But there is evidence that these nightlight clouds have been increasing in number, and some attribute it to these activities in the lower stratosphere by both the commercial jets and by NASA. So, yeah, there's a whole lot of questions and things going on that we really need to get better understanding of.
Let me do a station
well,
ID.
This is a digression a bit. We're off our topic a little bit, but
yeah.
You're an expert on these things. What's your opinion of what they call global dimming?
Okay, I need to do a station ID. We're running late here.
Okay.
You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio. And this evening I have Dr. Eric Carlstrom and Dr. Timothy Ball as our guest. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, global dimming.
Yeah. Well, the global dimming was another one of the difficulties that the people proposing human CO2 as the cause is that there are periods of climate that the CO2 simply doesn't fit at all. It's certainly not fitting the trend right now, which is why they've switched from global warming to climate change. The particularly troublesome one was, of course, from 1940 to 1980, approximately, when the world was cooling down. And they initially came out and said, oh, well, it's the sulfates that we've been adding to the atmosphere. And one of the great problems with all of this, apart from the issues we've talked about and many others, are a thing called aerosols. That is the particulate matters in the atmosphere. Now, it runs into the billions of tons, and there's some amazing stuff floating around in our atmosphere. For example, every time there's a locust plague in Africa, live locusts will end up falling on the Caribbean, carried across by the winds. And fortunately, they're past the egg-laying stage, so they don't get transferred. But and I remember watching the formation of a new volcanic island off the south coast of Iceland back in 1963, an island called Surtsey. And scientists went in with completely sterilized outfits on. They wanted to see how quickly the island became populated by plants and animals. And the first thing that arrived were spiders, which are drifting around on big long threads of gossamer around the world. So what's in the atmosphere is really quite phenomenal. And, of course, it varies. And I'll give you an example of how this created problems, Eric and Melody, was when they first started getting satellite measures of sea surface temperatures, they were in variance with what the actual water temperatures were showing by as much as 7 degrees Celsius. And they finally realized that what was happening was that they were actually measuring the temperature off of these particles in the atmosphere, these solid particles in the atmosphere, not actually measuring sea surface temperature. So the aerosol issue, and you can Google it and see that it's a huge problem for the computer models and the understanding of what's going on in the atmosphere. And of course, global dimming was a part of that claim.
So they would say that, let me just get this straight. What we see, if we look at the actual temperature records of the 20th century, we see warming up to about 1940, and then we see a cooling trend that goes to about 1975.
Right.
All of this time, humans are burning more fossil fuels and more CO2 is being added. And then in 75 to 1998, it has been warming slightly.
Right.
So you're saying global dimming then became a hypothesis to explain the fact that we saw cooling between 1940 and 1975 rather than the expected warming. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And of course, one of the things that's interesting with all of it is that whenever they look for an explanation, it always has to be a human cause. Because,
right.
of course, their focus is on human causes of climate change, not natural variability.
Yeah.
And anybody that looks at the climate record, even just the last 20,000 years, when we've emerged from the last ice age, the Wisconsin Ice Age, knows that climate changes dramatically all the time and in very short periods of time. But of course, that goes against the prevailing view of nature and nature natural systems in Western science.
Well, I find this kind of interesting, because how long would they have had to sit down and plug in the variables and all the things that would take for them to try to pass this information off as true science?
Well, that's a very good question, Melanie. It goes right to the heart of the problem with the computer models and the IPCC. You see, what they keep doing is that when the record doesn't fit what they're claiming, then they go back and keep plugging things into the model until it approximates the actual record, and then they claim, oh, that they've improved the understanding of the computer model. They haven't. All they've done is plug in things until it appears to approximate, and it's a post facto correction of the models that really is laughable. But that's what they've been doing all along. And as I said, the particular one that was critical was that cooling period of the 1940s to 75, as Eric said. And of course, Eric, by the way, in the period from 1900 to 1940, human production of CO2 was not very great, and yet that was the largest amount of warming in the 20th century. And then when humans really got going after with the Second World War and post-war, the temperature actually dropped while we were producing more CO2. And of course, now they've got the difficulty that CO2 levels are continuing to rise according to the Mauna Loa record, yet the global temperature has leveled and is declining.
Yeah, so the only way that they can maintain this fear level and try to coerce the societies into radical changes is to corrupt the science and to continue to silence people like yourself that actually understand something about climate. But before we get to natural climate, which is the most important and interesting thing to me, let me just read a few quotes here to show the ideological and political nature of this. Angela Merkel, German chancellor, said climate change is the greatest threat that human civilization has ever faced. One IPCC principal research scientist said the planet is on course for a catastrophe. The existence of life itself is at stake. Sir James Lovelock, one of Britain's premier scientists, a chemist, who wrote a book called The Revenge of Gaia, said, by the end of this century, climate change will reduce the human population to a few breeding pairs surviving near the Arctic. And then if we start to listen and we go behind the curtain, like the Wizard of Oz, we hear some of the policy people, like Timothy Wirth, president of the United Nations Foundation, saying, we've got to ride this global warming issue. Even if the theory of global warming is wrong, we will be doing the right thing in terms of economic and environmental policy. And a Club of Rome statement coming out of 1973 book, The First Global Revolution, said, in search of a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. So what we're seeing is a political agenda being advanced under the guise of, well, in this case, really bad science. And I can go on. I got lots and lots of quotes here. We can find out who these people are.
Sure.
Paul Watson, co-founder of Greenpeace, said, it doesn't matter what is true. It only matters what people believe is true.
Right.
Christine Stewart, former Canadian Minister of the Environment, no matter if the science of global warming is all phony, climate change provides the greatest opportunity to bring about justice and equality in the world. So this has got nothing to do with science anymore.
No.
And even if we look at the computer models, back to that topic, what we see is that they don't even claim to give predictions. They claim to give projections.
And their
projections are all over the map. They're somewhere between, it's always warming, of course.
It's the revenge
of
the computer.
I think maybe 1.5 degrees centigrade and 11, or maybe it's Fahrenheit, 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit and 11.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century or something like that. And so they have no internal consistency whatsoever. You can dial a different computer program and get a different projection.
Yeah. Well, and they call them scenarios as well. And of course, what a lot of people don't understand is they're not simply, because you're using, you know, Fahrenheit, and you assume, oh, that's a temperature forecast. In fact, it's a combination of economics and the climate science combined. So when they come up with that figure, they're saying, well, if the industrial growth continues at this rate, then the CO2 production will continue at this rate, therefore the temperature will go up at this rate. So they're not even pure climate science scenarios or projections. They're a combination of economics and climate science. So they're worse than that. And then when you look at the IPCC, and again, another thing that Strong set up when he organized it, there's 2,500 scientists, which is the group they always claim is the consensus, but actually they're broken into three groups. Working Group 1 is the science, they produce the science report or technical report. That's 600 people. Now the number of those that actually do the report and the research is only about 14. John McLean, an Australian, has broken it down. And very few of them are actually qualified as climate scientists. So they produce the working group report. The other 1,900 of the 2,500 are in working groups 2 and 3. They accept, without question, the findings of working group 1 and then say, okay, global warming is going to happen. Now we'll look at the impact of that. And so they come up with all of these impact studies. Oh, well, you know, the mosquitoes are going to spread wider and all the things that Worth talked about and you mentioned earlier. And, of course, those are the things that get quoted into the media. But they're all based on this assumption that Working Group 1 is correct.
Yeah. And so much of the actually funded research, like you say, biologists, et cetera, is a kind of a scenario thing. What if you get a warming of say 8 degrees Fahrenheit, how would it affect this population of squirrels or some other organism? And so they assume as proven that which needs to be proven and hasn't been proven. That's their starting assumption, is that there is going to be this great global warming, and then they spend our tax dollars or whatever to show us what would then happen. And I've seen this in many, many, many TV documentaries. In California, for instance, one called California Heat, and they say, oh, this valley is going to, you know, burn up and blah, 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 blah. When the temperature goes up to this amount, and they never discuss the science that would support or suggest that, in fact, the temperature is going to go up by that amount.
Right? Well, one of the things about that, Eric, of course, is also this assumption that global warming is totally negative, that everything is going to be worse. In fact, the historic record shows that the world is better under global warming, and certainly many of the cold countries, for example, Canada, we would need less heating fuel for our homes, and we'd need less fuel. For example, in the Arctic now, very rarely do they shut the diesel engines down on because they can't start them in the cold weather, so they just let them run all winter. And so there are many places where a 1 or 2 degree warming would be very beneficial, but you never hear about that. In fact, I wrote an article about that, and I got the most vehement, nasty response of anything I'd ever written. So it's all about negative, negative, negative.
How do you think this is carried over into the sustainable development issues that are feeding off of this?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was the head of the World Commission on Sustainability, and created that term, sustainable development, which I've described as the perfect political phrase because it means everything to everyone and nothing to anyone. And I discovered that when I was looking at sustainable agriculture. Now, that term works because you know what agriculture is. You can define it. But the sustainable development term only works if you turn it around. And if you turn it around and say we need to develop a sustainable society, then it works. But as sustainable development, it doesn't work for a couple of reasons. One is that nothing is sustainable. Entropy, nothing's sustainable forever. And development generally means uncontrolled growth. And that, of course, we define in the body as cancer. So the term sustainable development just creates nothing but confusion in people's minds. But as I said, if you turn it around in a simple syntax exercise to say we need to develop a sustainable society, then it works. But that was part of this whole thing. This was part of the UNEP program. All of this was coming at the same time and was part of the whole thrust that we've been talking about here this evening.
Now, are they talking about these same issues? I mean, you got Maurice Strong over there in China. Is he trying to sell this over there?
Well, what Maurice Strong is doing in China, as far as I understand, is that he's evading the U.S. government that want to investigate him for his role and his son's role and Kofi Annan and his son's role in the food for oil in Iraq fiasco. And that he fled to China in order to avoid that. But he and George Soros have set up a company. They're doing two things. One is that they're going to import very cheap cars from China into the U.S. And, of course, that's the hypocrisy of these people. They make enormous amounts of money off of this and yet, decry the industrialized nations. But also they're setting up the whole carbon credit thing because, of course, China will be in the forefront of selling carbon credits. And Strong is also, by the way, on the board of the largest carbon credit trading group in Chicago, the Chicago Carbon Exchange, and Strong's on the board of that. So they're busy making their money, as is Al Gore, off of these things. And for me, that's really the ultimate hypocrisy of it.
Well, it would seem like that if China is also developing, then they're probably ignoring a lot of these issues that would be participating in what they were trying to purport as being global warming issues.
Well, the thing with China, and I can say this from having worked with Chinese climatologists, particularly back when before Mao died, and they were looking at, they realized they had to increase their food production. They wanted to become independent of, internal food supply, just as the U.S. does with energy. And the only place they could really do that was in the north. So to study Canada's methods of food production were very applicable to Manchuria. And the Chinese understand climate and climate change far better than the West. And of course, they also were excluded from the Kyoto. I mean, they were part of the Kyoto Accord, but they were not required to meet any targets as a developing nation. And you've got the ultimate irony now that they have basically controlled the U.S. financially, having bailed you out in your debt, but they are still demanding their carbon credit money from the original Kyoto Accord, which to me is one of the ultimate ironies of this. But India and China were both excluded from Kyoto, and of course they're continuing that stance with this whole new cap and trade and restriction on growth. And so for any country to do it unilaterally is just economic suicide.
Is this, you think this message now is understood in Washington, that it would be economic suicide if the United States passed these cap and trade laws?
It obviously wasn't in the House because Nancy Pelosi was able to persuade enough people overnight so that they added 300 pages to the bill, which were basically buy-offs of Democratic and Republican, some Republican senators. So the House did approve it. I think they only approved it by 7 votes, so it was pretty close. But what I understand is that the Senate won't approve it. But that doesn't come up in the Senate, I think, until October or November. And my betting is that it won't get through the Senate, because I think enough senators understand. And as I said, the last time they voted on Kyoto, which was a similar thing, was 95-0. Because the one thing that the senators will put ahead of environmental issues is jobs and the economy. And when you look at what it's done to Spain, for example, I mean, they've now found that all the green jobs they created actually eliminated more jobs than it created. And so there's lots of evidence out there for them.
So the cap and trade.
I've read various analyses that if this legislation were passed, that it would cost trillions of dollars to the U.S. economy, or it would involve, $7,000 per family per year. I've read various scenarios on that. Do you have one figure that you've
The $7,000 figure has been kicking around. I've heard as low as $3,500. I mean, it depends. Again, economics are as bad at forecasting as weather guys are. So pretty much, in fact, somebody once said about economics is they tried to forecast the tide by measuring one wave. and that's certainly true. But here's the bottom line with all of it. Even if the original Kyoto Accord, with every country in the world signing on and meeting their targets, was achieved, it would make absolutely no difference, or no measurable difference, to the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. Or to temperature. I mean, again, we're assuming that the CO2 is driving temperature, and that's not shown not to be true. But as I pointed out to people, if we took everybody off the planet, shut everything down, left one scientist behind to measure the change in CO2 in the atmosphere, they would not be able to measure that change. Because our production relative to the amount that's coming from natural sources, and we're going to talk about natural variability, just three natural sources, oceans, for example, the estimates, and all we have are estimates, it ranges from 90 to 100 gigatons. So that's a 10 gigaton range of error in the estimate. Well, human production net is about 4 gigatons a year. So the amount we produce is within the range of the error of the estimate just for the oceans. And then when you take the error of the estimate for soils, venting from soils, and from rotting vegetation, we're within the error of the estimates of both of those as well. So that's why I can say if all the people on the planet left, that scientist would not be able to measure any detectable difference in the total amount in the atmosphere.
Help me understand then. How is the cap and trade tied to the CO2? Where's that correlation?
Well, that's a very good question. The best analogy, I wrote an article on this a while ago, the cap and trade or carbon credits are very much like indulgences in the medieval church where you could sin and then buy your way into heaven. Well, the cap and trade or carbon credits will do nothing to decrease the amount of CO2 people are producing. And in fact, I argue it will increase it because people that want to produce more will simply buy the carbon credits from somebody else and continue to increase their amount they're producing. So what the carbon credits was originally about in the original Kyoto was that it was a transfer of wealth. It was part of Maurice Strong's and others' idea that we're going to take the wealth from these industrialized nations who've achieved it by exploiting these poor underdeveloped nations, and we're going to redistribute the wealth. And so it never was about never could have achieved any reduction in CO2 going into the atmosphere. It was all about transfer of wealth. And, of course, that's why, as I said, China are saying, well, you owe us $2 billion in carbon credits from the original Kyoto, and we want our money. Now, it's now changed into, and why they changed the name from carbon credit or carbon tax, which is really what it is, into cap and trade, is that those words make it sound nice. Oh, we're going to cap the production of these nasty, evil CO2, and then we're going to create a jobs by having a trading market in it. But the trading market is a complete, it's a monopoly game. The government are going to decide who gets what carbon credits and how they can trade them. And in fact, Obama said when he was running for office, he said, I'm going to shut the coal industry down. I'll put caps on their industry that will bankrupt them. And of course, so what it does is not only create that trading, but it provides total control by the government of industry.
So that's why we got clean burning coal coming out of that.
Yeah. Well, clean burning coal's been around for 40 years. The problem was that up until, well, even now, it means that the cost of your electricity is going to double. But the ability to scrub the coal and the output of the coal plants, and in fact, a consortium of three private businesses built a clean burning coal plant in North Dakota. And it's been functioning very well for quite some time. And so that technology has been around, but of course, people say they want to do these things and they want to this, that, and the other, but when the bill comes in, they're suddenly not so eager. And I play this game with students. I'll talk to a grade 12 class and say, well, you guys care about the environment. Yeah, rah, rah, rah. And I say, okay, none of you will ever drive cars. And you get that look on their faces, well, don't care that much, you know. And, of course, that's what's going on right now with the whole environmental movement is how much how willing are people to pay for these things? How much are they willing to pay? And of course, that's what's really being tested. And what we're finding out is that when push comes to shove, people are generally not willing to pay, and particularly if they sense that the evidence has been doctored or is not accurately used, which is what's happening with the climate change issue.
And that's the whole thing, is we need to start asking the questions and prove that the fact that, you know, this is all built on premises that is based on nothing.
Yeah. But you see, up until now, Melody, what's been going on is that anybody that dared to question was immediately marginalized. You were identified. You were outed, if you want, in the gay term, and you were picked upon and said, "Oh, you don't care about the environment. You don't care about the children. You don't care about the future," and basically bullied into silence. And politicians are still that way. They're terrified to make any statement or not support something that might suggest that they don't care about the environment or they could be accused of that. And so there's been a massive bullying going on throughout the society. Now gradually it's starting to change, but it takes time.
And look what that does to you guys as scientists. I mean, when they're out putting out bad information and trying to get you guys tied into this, that just kind of really should anger you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, my concern now, and I know Eric has thought about this, is that we have to think about how the public are going to react when they find out how much they've been misled on these issues by scientists being politicians and political scientists in that sense. And the credibility of science is going to be shot. And issues that we do need to deal with, they'll say, well, we don't believe anything you tell us. They'll throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, right. If I could just report an incident. I still teach at California State University Stanislaus, and I teach climatology and geomorphology and human ecology, things like that. I was in the Xerox room making a test one day, and I happened to talk with one of my fellow professors who's a political scientist, and we're just chatting, getting to know each other a little bit. Turns out he was going to go to Europe this summer to give a talk on global warming. And he's in the political science department. But he told me he had a master's in ecology, therefore he was an expert. So here we have have a guy, who basically is spreading the propaganda line around the world making his career, and he's a political scientist. He's not a scientist. He's a political scientist. So this is very widespread and very pernicious, and it's been very difficult to stand. And this is why, of course, we have all of us, you know, can admire what you've done, Dr. Bala. You've actually gotten death threats. Because
Let me just speak. There's an important science. Sorry, Melody, did you have to do a station break or something?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. What I was going to say was there's a very important issue in all of this, and it is the fact that climatology as a discipline is a generalist discipline. That is, if you're going to understand the climate and even the weather, when you stand outside and experience the weather, you're experiencing everything from cosmic radiation from deep space to geothermal heat coming off the bottom of the ocean and everything in between. And so climatology is a generalist discipline, but we're living in an age in which specialization is glorified. And you hear this with, I love to point out, people say, well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. Well, what's the implication of that? That somehow a rocket scientist is smarter than the rest of us? No, I'm sorry. I don't buy that. So this is why people can come along and say, well, you know, I've spent my whole career studying methane, and methane's the answer, and this is the issue. When in fact, it's just one very small part. And if we look at climate as, say, a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, well, how do you do the jigsaw puzzle? Well, the first thing you do is find the corner pieces. Well, in terms of the climate puzzle, the corner pieces are the oceans, the atmosphere, deep space, including sun, and then within the Earth itself, the lithosphere. Well, we haven't even got those clearly defined yet, the four corner pieces. And then when you start putting in the edge pieces, we're all over the place. So when we start to do the climate puzzle, we haven't got the box stop to start off with. And then you've got each person, there's 1,000 people running around, each with a piece of the puzzle. And so this is why there can be so many people that can suddenly morph from being in one area to suddenly say, well, I'm a climatologist. And I play this game now because I just, when people say, well, what are you? I say, well, I'm a climatologist and I'm an environmentalist. Well, you see people come on television as environmentalists. Well, where do they get that title? We're all environmentalists. How dare these people take that title? But of course, what they're doing with that title is saying, well, I care about the environment and the rest of you don't. But this is part of this whole thing about specialization, fragmentation of the world into individual pieces, but now we're trying to put it back together again. And Eric would be familiar with this. We saw it in the universities, that increasingly departments broke down into smaller and smaller parts and smaller fragments. And then, starting in about the 1970s, they were trying to solve problems that crossed over some of these areas, and we suddenly got interdisciplinary studies, trying to pull some of these bits and pieces together. But that's been a major problem for the study of climate, and why people can just arbitrarily say, well, I'm a climatologist.
Yeah. Well, if we could, we only have a limited time left, so... Yeah. I think both of us are very fascinated with the whole business of long and short-term climate cycles,
right.
And climate change. And, of course, before this interview started, you and I were, Dr. Ball, were talking about, you were telling me about a conference in Warsaw, which occurred, 1990?
1990, yeah.
Yeah, could you explain a little bit about the issues that came up then and what happened?
Well, what came up at that conference was that essentially the conference divided into two groups. I'm always leery about saying that because, H.L. Mencken said you can divide the world into two groups, those that will divide the world into two groups and those that won't. But it essentially divided into two groups. The one group was essentially the Western world, Western Europe and America, who were saying that the weather and climate was chaotic and unpredictable and so on. The Russians, the Soviets, as they were at that time, and the Eastern Bloc, and the Chinese, by the way, were saying that it's cycles, that everything is a cycle, but there are a multitude of cycles, and to sort them all out and to understand not only the individual individual cycles, but how they're interacting with each other is really what we've got to do. Now, the Russians have a long history of studying cycles, not only in weather and climate, but also in economics. In fact, one of the oldest economic cycles is called the Kondratiev cycle. And Kondratiev came up with a cycle of wheat prices and you know, economic collapse based upon failure of the wheat harvest is one of the original ones. But after that 1990 conference, it unfortunately was said, oh, well, the division was a political ideological split, when in fact it wasn't. It was a very fundamental scientific split between those that believed that things were chaotic and therefore unpredictable, and the Russians and the East saying, no, that it was a matter of cycles. And I've got to say, I've been in the cycle camp and peddling for a long time.
Yeah, and would you explain, and of course I am too, and yeah. So is my father, who put in a whole career looking at paleoclimate as a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, so he's got over 50 years of research on this, So I've obviously been influenced by his work, but would you explain what some of those major and minor cycles are, Tim, so that people can get an idea that what humans have done is negligible compared to what nature has done?
Yeah, well, of course, the first person to in history, as far as we know, to infer that there were cycles, particularly in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, was the Frenchman Adhémar, Adhémar, and he suggested, based upon Louis Agassiz's idea that there were ice ages, that an explanation might be found in changing orbit of the Earth. And that, of course, you know, we're talking 1830s that this is occurring. But that basically sits dormant for a long time. And then we started to get people studying how these orbital variations and changes in what's called the sun-earth relationships were a factor in climate. One of the first was a Scottish scientist by the name of James Croll. And he spent his whole life in the back of his shop, so that his business almost went broke, calculating how changes in the orbit of the Earth would affect the climate. Now, we've known about orbital changes for 150 years, which Croll was working on them at that time, and yet our textbooks, up and still a lot of them, are telling the students that the orbit of the Earth around the Sun is a fixed elliptical orbit. It isn't, and they understood that the orbital changes are primarily caused by the gravitational pull of the planet Jupiter, and that orbital change is 100,000 years. It goes from extreme ellipse to almost circular as it is now, and back to extreme ellipse again. And that was the first one. The second one, about 20 years later, so about 130 years ago, was the changing tilt. Not just the wobble of the Earth, but the actual tilt of the Earth changing. So 23.5 is what all the school textbooks show, but it actually varies between 21.8 and 24.4. and oscillates back and forth. So if you change the tilt, you change the where the Arctic and Antarctic circles are, the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, and all the rest of the things that are critical in distribution of heat energy around the world. And then there's a third one called the precession of the equinoxes, but that doesn't come in until quite a bit later. And then in the 1930s, a fellow by the name of Milutin Milankovic, who was a Serbian in what was Yugoslavia at that time, put all three of these cyclical events together, and he calculated how the amount of energy received at the Earth would change, and he did it every year over a 400,000 year period for every 5 degrees of latitude. So this is pre-computer days, so the amount of calculations is phenomenal. And he came out with this pattern of solar energy received at the Earth. And, of course, then it was fit against the known, what was now known, the ice ages, which, of course, Louis Agassiz had been working on. And we suddenly got this realization that particularly the 100,000-year orbital cycle fit very well with the ice ages and interglacials. Now, when I started out in the 1980s, Milankovic had already been rejected. It was widely accepted in the 50s, And then because of some conflict between what Milankovitch was saying was happening in Alaska and what radiocarbon dating was showing, Milankovitch got rejected. And it wasn't until almost 1990 that I recall a conference where somebody mentioned Milankovitch and nobody questioned it. But those are the major cycles. Now, beyond that, there are much longer cycles. For example, we know that there are major ice events every 250 million years, and there's a theory about that because of the orbit of the Sun around the Milky Way and passing through galactic arms of dust every 250 million years. So there's some very, very long cycles. Now, on a shorter time basis, of course, there are the cycles of the Sun, the 11-year sunspot cycle, the 22-year sunspot cycle, and then the solar activity cycles that go beyond that. I can never remember the name, but there's one of about 90 to 100 years.
Cycle.
Yeah, the climate, that's the one, exactly. Yeah, thank you, Eric. Yeah, my mind, it slipped me there. But and then there are longer ones, 1200 year, 2400 year. And those are the cycles. Now, we've also got, of course, cycles such as the El Nino events within the Earth, the oceans, and the atmosphere. But, of course, the question is how much are those being driven by these external forcing mechanisms of the sun? And, for example, with El Nino, there was two, Karen Libitsky and Eric Van Loon showed a very high correlation between the El Nino cycles and the solar cycles. So it appears that most of the cycles that we see within the Earth ocean atmosphere system are being driven by these external forcing cycle systems.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, and we've got a lot of cycles already, that my father's work, Thor Karlstrom, has been focused on higher frequency, shorter term cycles of about, well, as you mentioned, 1,100 years, 550, and that breaks down to a harmonic of 256 and 139, which would be resonances of the variations in the lunar effects, the moon's pull on the Earth. So it does seem like we have to look outside of ourselves. We have to look to our solar system. The sun is a variable star. The Earth and all the planets are, you know, revolving around the sun, and our orbit is not constant. It varies over time. And when we look at the Earth in its larger context, then we can start to understand these cycles. So the Milankovitch theory is sometimes called the astronomic theory of climate change. So we have to look beyond human activity. We're nothing in this.
Yeah, well, just one interesting point. I don't want to go back to the IPCC again, because we covered a lot of that tonight, but in the computer models that the IPCC use, and in fact everybody uses, the Milankovitch effect is not included. And I was on a radio station here in Victoria talking about this, and Andrew Weaver phoned in. Now, Andrew Weaver has been the lead author on the computer model section of the IPCC reports, and he acknowledged that they were not included, but he said, well, they're too long, the cycles are too long for short-term climate fluctuation. And I said, well, hang on a minute, Andrew, the orbit changes every year. The tilt changes every year, and it may be very small amounts, but certainly it equals the amount of forcing that the human CO2 might cause. But more important, since you're projecting for 100 years, then it does become important. So here we've got a major known forcing mechanism of the sun, the Milankovitch cycle. It is not included in their computer models. And so it really underscores what's going on.
How about the solar magnetic variations? Are they included?
No. The solar magnetic variations, one of the things that we've known for a very long time is the relationship between sunspots and global temperature. The difficulty, as you know, Eric, is that you can have a correlation, but you cannot assume cause and effect from that. You have to know what the mechanism is before you can start saying there is a cause and effect. And for the longest time, and certainly in all the early years, the IPCC rejected this relationship between sunspots and global temperature because they said there was no cause and effect, no mechanism. In 1991, Fritz Christensen came out with the idea that the sunspots, in fact, were not causing the temperature change, but they were simply a manifestation of changes in the sun's magnetic field strength, and that this was the real cause of the change. Now, since then, and particularly starting in 2000, Svensmark worked with Christensen. Now Svensmark published with Calder in a book called The Chilling Stars. And that what happens is that what they're arguing is that as the sun's magnetic field varies, which we can visibly see with the number of sunspots, it controls the amount of cosmic radiation reaching the surface of the Earth. So it's almost like a gate opening and closing. The amount of cosmic radiation reaching to the lower atmosphere then determines the amount of low cloud that's formed. And so that cosmic radiation is essentially creating cloud, which is much like opening and closing a shutter in a greenhouse, controlling the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth or reflecting back to space. And so that mechanism is now pretty well established. In fact, just recently, another paper published by Svensmark with further evidence of it. Now, the IPCC have effectively ignored that. They talked about it briefly in the 2001 report, but the 2007 report, they almost totally dismissed it. Now, one of their arguments was, well, it wasn't in the literature early enough for inclusion, but as I said, this has been there since 2000, so they really don't have that excuse. And by the way, Eric, it talks to another problem that we've always had in weather and climate, and that is that in order for water to condense, follow water vapor as a gas in the atmosphere, it needs those particles that I talked about, the aerosols, and these form what they're called condensation nuclei. Now, we knew there were two major sources of them. One is the salt from the oceans, and the other is clay particles, the finest dust particles. But there never seemed to be enough to explain all the cloud that was forming. Well, now with this explanation, that is it is the cosmic rays that are forming muons in the lower atmosphere that become the condensation nuclei. This explains that particular problem. So and by the way, I would just finish this. I mean, there's a lot of other things to talk about, but I happen to think that magnetism is one of the most important forces, not only in weather and climate, but in the whole globe and control of things in the globe that is really being ignored.
Well, you know, in our little conversation before this interview started, you did mention something, Tim, about the declining magnetic field of the sun. No, of the Earth, excuse me, right now.
Earth, yes.
And
yeah.
How this might, and the occasional polarity reversals that we have, and how this might affect many systems, including extinction of species, et cetera. And what would be the effect on the climate of the changing magnetic field of the Earth now, not the sun?
Well, we don't really have a good measure of that. We do know, as I said, the sun's magnetic field is acting like a gate to control cosmic radiation coming in. But obviously the magnetic field also controls what reaches the surface of the Earth. One of the ways that we can see that is that the particles that are trapped in the upper atmosphere create a static electricity, which then causes the gases in the upper atmosphere to glow, and that's, of course, the aurora, both the Borealis and Australis. So the magnetic field is extremely important. If you want to put it in Star Wars terms, it's like a force field protecting us from harmful radiation from the sun. But we do know from the geologic record that the Earth's polarity reverses itself. This has been known for quite some time. And the reason we know it is every time that lava pours out of a volcano, as it cools at a certain temperature called the Curie point, because Madame Curie was the first to discover this, the particles in it that are sensitive to the, to magnetism, particularly magnetite, align themselves with the Earth's magnetic field at that time. So as you go down through the layers of lava, you will find normal polarity, and we, of course, we arrogantly call what we're in normal, with the North Pole where it is in South Pole, and then all of a sudden the next layer will be with the reverse polarity, with the South Pole being where the North Pole is. So what the lava is almost like a magnetic tape recording these polarity reversals. Now they occur in what are called epochs. That is, you'll have about a million years, which is majority of it normal or the majority of it reversed. But one of the perplexing things is in the middle of a normal, you can have a sudden, relatively rapid reversal event. And those, as I said, are called events. We're really not quite sure how this is done. We do know, as I said, that magnetism is reversing. But you see, it goes back to the problem of what's creating the Earth's magnetic field. It was originally thought that it was created simply by the Earth spinning, but if that's true, then in order to reverse the polarity, the Earth has to stop spinning in one direction and start spinning in another direction. And there's no evidence to support that. The more general theory that is in vogue now is that we know the Earth is made up of three separate spheres. The solid inner core, the liquid outer core, and then the mantle, and then the crust, of course, a very thin veneer over all of that. But each of these spheres is rotating at a different speed. And what it appears happens is that each, as it's spinning, induces a magnetic field, but as one cancels out another, then the total magnetic field declines and then rebuilds with a reverse polarity. Now, the geologic evidence suggests this takes about 1,000 years to occur. And so there's a gradual declining and then a zero magnetic field and then the growth of the magnetic field with a reverse polarity. Now, one of the concerns is that we know that the Earth's magnetic field, which is measured in Gaussian units, has been weakening for about 1,000 years now. And the concern is that if a simple linear trend, you take that forward, then you can sort of pinpoint that a polarity reversal is in the offing. But as I said, I'm not going to get into more scare scenarios. There's enough of them around already.
Right. You don't see a linkage between that dynamic right now and climatic phenomena.
Well, exactly how the climate would react to this is not clear. I mean, we do know, for example, that, and you mentioned the lunar cycles, and it appears that a lot of that influence is because of it interfering with the Earth's magnetic field. And so exactly what the mechanisms are is very, very little understood. I mean, the work of your father in determining these events and getting the data so that we can at least have some chance of trying to find some explanatory mechanisms is still in the very early stages, and partly because, of course, the idea of cycles is still essentially rejected.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I think one of the reasons why Marie Strong and the IPCC and the politicians have been able to make as much headway as they have with this scare scenario of man-caused global warming is that, as you said, the science of climatology and paleoclimatology is still in its infancy. We don't have a generally agreed upon theory of climate change, and it is enormously complex. So it's relatively easy to take, you know, to show some footage of some melting ice in Antarctica in the springtime or whatever, or big hurricane and say that we have a trend that's global. And, of course, that's not the case.
No, what they're in fact doing is that they're taking natural events and then presenting them as if they're unnatural. And, of course, what that means is then they can never be wrong because tomorrow there's going to be more natural events. And because the public don't know what is natural, what are normal, it works very well. But when they come out and say, well, and I love this, and they come out and say, well, this is the hottest day ever. And I said, well, the world's 5 billion years old. Are you sure you mean ever? And then you say, well, no, it's in government record. Oh, my goodness, how did we ever survive before we had government records, you know? So it is that ability to play on that. And then the other thing, as I said earlier in the program, the idea that the whole of Western science starts with the assumption that change is very gradual over long periods of time, when that is simply not the case at all. That plays into it as well. And by the way, Eric, I just mentioned, when we do know from the geologic record that when the Earth's magnetic field collapses during these, there are extensive extinction of species on the planet, particularly soft-bodied creatures in the deep ocean or the shallower oceans. And so, of course, we also know, by the way, that DNA is very much affected by ultraviolet radiation. And, of course, when you get rid of the magnetic field and the ozone, you get more of that coming into the Earth system. And what that would do to the DNA of all living creatures is really, really not known.
Right. But I think that what we can learn from Earth science and the work of countless Earth scientists is that the average temperature of the Earth has fluctuated wildly over the past 4.5 billion years. The scenarios I've read are that for the first nearly billion years, the temperature of the Earth was above 70 degrees centigrade on average, and then it started to gradually cool. And then we got thrown into two episodes at least of what they call Snowball Earth, where the planet froze. And the estimated average temperatures at that time, about 2.5 billion and about 700 million years ago, but is minus 40 to minus 50 degrees centigrade. So right there you have from above 70 degrees centigrade to below, to minus 50, that's 120 degrees centigrade. That's that's beyond the, you know, the range of boiling and freezing of water for our planet. So our planet has, when they talk about saving the planet, it becomes absurd. And our 1 degree Fahrenheit warming, which is also questionable in the 20th century, is nothing compared to that.
Well, let's just talk about that 1 degree Fahrenheit for a minute, because that, I talked earlier about the hockey stick, which was one of the big, a weapon. They should have got a penalty for high sticking with that, but it's beyond that, the other piece of the IPCC reports that got so much attention was this claim of this 1 degree Fahrenheit or 0.6 degrees Celsius increase over the last 130 years. Well, the first thing is, we've got very, very few records of that length. And not only that, but they tend to be concentrated in middle latitude cities. So outside of that, we really have very little. But more importantly, the person who came up with that number was the head of, or the director of, the climatic research unit at East Anglia in England, a fellow by the name of Phil Jones. Okay. And, when he was asked by Warwick Hughes, an Australian climatologist who's really done a lot of work on temperature records and data and so on, and Hughes asked him how he came up with that number, which stations did he use, and how did he adjust those records for things like changes in instruments, as an example. And Jones wrote back in an email, a now infamous email, saying, why should I provide you with this data? It's 25 years of work, and all you want to do is find fault with it. And the most recent, and you can read about this on McIntyre's website, Climate Audit, they have tried through Freedom of Information, through the United Kingdom Met Office and to the University of East Anglia, where the CRU is based, to get Jones to tell them how he calculated this number, and he still refuses to give it. And the UK Met Office is now caught up in saying, well, there's privacy agreements that we can't disclose it, and so on. Well, this is public data. It's public information, and particularly the fact that that number is now used by everybody to say, well, look, this is how much the world has warmed. And then they've also said, oh, well, this is a more rapid warming than could occur naturally, which is also nonsense. And here we've got the guy that produced the number refusing to disclose how he did it. And it's the most remarkable thing you can imagine, but that's what's happening.
Let me give a station ID here, and I mean, we actually have the ability to continue on a little further if you guys would like to, or we can end it here however you like, but you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KAGN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and we've been talking with my co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest, Dr. Timothy Ball.
Well, I'm still energetic. If you are, Tim,
I'm game to go. It's whatever Melody can do.
I'm fine.
We had kind of a rocky start. We lost probably about 20 minutes, so it would be fun if we could make this a 2-hour interview.
Sure.
And I really appreciate you coming on and being willing to stay up this late.
No
okay, this is a fascinating aspect that you just bring about, which is that in all the IPCC reports, it's repeated over and over again that we've seen 1 degree Fahrenheit warming globally on average for the planet in the 20th century, but we don't know exactly how this fellow Jones at the UK Met Office came up with that measurement, and he doesn't want to tell us.
Right.
So what is your opinion then of that estimate? What do you think the truth is?
Well, I think the truth is that the reason he doesn't want to disclose it is because, of course, he has adjusted the data, much as James Hansen is doing with the NASA GIF data, to make it look warmer than it actually is. And by the way, we know about what Hansen is doing at NASA GIS because here's one of the fascinating things. We've got weather stations around the world, and yet two major producers of the world temperatures, using that same data, come up with different numbers. And of course that occurs because it's what they do with the raw data and how they adjust it. Now, one of the big factors, and we've known about this since 1933, when a German researcher by the name of Kratzer was doing, he was looking at the problem of pollution with trees in the Ruhr Valley in Germany, and by taking temperature measurements, he discovered that the cities were warmer than the surrounding countryside, and he didn't call it that, but it's now become called the urban heat island effect. And the first serious study on that was done by Chandler in London, England, in 1952. And of course, Chandler showed that there was the cities had a distinctly different climate because of all of the concrete and asphalt absorbing the heat, and also the changes in the amount of moisture in the atmosphere, and the pollutants, of course. And so it became known as the urban heat island effect. I got involved in this back in 1972. We were doing urban heat island studies in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And of course that was an ideal location for these studies because out on that flat plain of the prairies, you didn't have to worry about different elevation effects. You had a nice flat isotropic plain, as it's called, and then the city. And the warmest places, of course, are right at the center, what is called the Central Business District. Now, Warwick Hughes showed a wonderful example of this back in the late 90s, where he did a study of six Australian cities showing that about 1950, the temperature started to go up. And of course, everybody pointed at that and said, oh, there's the global warming. In fact, what was happening was that the car allowed the cities to expand, the suburbs to develop, and the weather stations were mostly at airports on the edge of cities, and the cities grew out around the weather stations and caused this artificial warming. And Warwick Hughes then took 26 rural weather stations in Australia and showed virtually no warming at all. And of course that's become a pretty classic study now. But we now know that even in relatively small communities, the temperature can be warmer than the surrounding countryside. Now you don't need to go far outside of those communities for the temperature to drop quite noticeably. But how much of this urban heat island effect you allow for in your temperature measurements, let's say for Chicago Airport or whatever, is going to determine what your final average is for the global temperature. And so each of these major agencies like NASA GIS or the climatic research unit that Jones is doing are making their adjustments in different ways, and of course we're not privy to how they're doing this, and I'm afraid the old biblical thing about the devil's work is done in the darkness is all too applicable here.
Yeah. Well, okay, so this 1 degree Fahrenheit, which I've used, many people would just keep repeating it like a mantra, becomes reality just on the basis of that repetition. It could be wildly wrong. Could be half of that. Could be even less than half of that. But we do know, and of course, people have been watching this very carefully in the last decade or two, that despite the fact that people like James Hansen of NASA have claimed that 2005 was the warmest year on record, and blah blah blah, that in fact people like I think McKittrich maybe it's McIntyre and McKittrich have shown that we have been cooling since 1998.
Sorry to jump in, Eric. Probably the best work on showing the cooling and getting a much more accurate measure of what's going on, and don't forget what Hansen and Jones and these people are using is surface weather stations. Those are those little white boxes with slats on them called Stevenson screens. The people that are, I think, are getting the better data because it covers the whole globe are the satellite temperature measurements, and particularly the work of John Christie and Roy Spencer at the University of Huntsville at Alabama. And of course, they're showing quite a different but a different picture than those surface weather stations are showing. But the difficulty with that, of course, is it's a relatively short record.
Right. The satellite data only goes back about 30 years, is that correct?
Yes. Yes. And by the way, that 30 years has become considered a normal. In fact, they talk about it as a climatic normal, as a 30-year span. That originated, and it was part of the thing that affected my research. The World Meteorological Organization had people saying, well, look, I've got some temperature records, as I had, for 1770, 1780 on Hudson Bay, and I want to be able to compare those with a period in the modern record. So the World Meteorological Organization said, well, look, we'll take 30 years as a statistically significant length of time. Now, they did that because statisticians will tell you that in any size population, a sample of 30 is statistically significant. So that's how they use that number. So they say, okay, we'll take 30 years. The first so-called normal period was from the temperature record from 1930 to 1961. And so, you know, you compared the records you had from the 18th century and so on with that period of time. The problem with that is that since that first normal period, 30 to 61, every 10 years they upgrade it. So right now they're upgrading from to 1970 to 2001. And of course, what's interesting is when you compare the averages between those normal 30-year periods, you see them changing as well. And it's based on the false assumption that a 30-year period in, say, 1936-1 is representative of climate over the historic time. Well, that's nonsense. That's like taking a basketball team and saying that the average height of the basketball team is representative of the height of the human population. That's how ludicrous it is. But it's become a standard measure, and a lot of people don't realize when you hear them on the radio saying, well, it's above normal. Well, the normal they're talking about is the most recent 30-year average.
Yeah,
it's not the normal.
It's a moving average.
Exactly. It's a moving
normal
average.
Normal is always changing. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not above normal, say, for a 100-year record.
Right.
And that's what you really need to be looking at. Yeah.
Well, one of the interesting questions that was left a little bit dangling during our last interview in May, Tim, was the fact that we've had about 23 sunspot cycles since Galileo first began observing sunspots in 1715, and we should be moving into the 24th cycle. Has that occurred yet? Have we moved into cycle 24?
Oh, okay, we're going to get emails if we don't get the numbers straight. Galileo 1610, the actual sunspot cycle numbers don't start until about 1735. So that's number one, and we're now in cycle 23. We should be going into 24. There have been a few sunspots, and by the way, it's measured by the reversal of the polarity of the sunspot themselves. And of course that's tied in with the solar magnetic variability. But we should be in cycle 24 now. There's been a few sunspots that appear to show the start of cycle 24, but then they've disappeared again. And one of the things that Svensmark and Christensen showed was it wasn't just the number of sunspots and the variability of that, but it was the length of the sunspot cycle. So the longer the delay from going from one sunspot cycle into the next, this is the 11-year, then the fewer sunspots for the subsequent cycles. And so the longer that we delay going into cycle 24, then cycle 25 and 26 and 27 will have fewer sunspots. And, of course, we know that the relationship is the fewer sunspots, the colder the temperatures on Earth. So as of right now, we're past the previous longest length of delay from one cycle to the next, which was comparable to the delay that occurred during what was called the Dalton Minimum. And that was a period from about 1790 to 1820. And, of course, that also correlated with the very cold temperatures. And we're now beyond that. And so people are starting to say that if it continues much longer, then we're looking at temperatures dropping down to as they were in the middle of the Little Ice Age. And that, in solar terms, was called the Maunder Minimum. And it was from about 1645 to 1710. And one of the interesting aspects of that historically was that approximately 70-year span covered the life of the great astronomer Sir Edmund Halley, of Halley's Comet fame. And he wrote a wonderful article in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society because sunspots had started to appear again, and of course the aurora that occur with them, and the Royal Society paid for him to go up to Scotland to witness them. And he knew about them. He'd read about them, the sunspots in Galileo, and he read about the aurora, but they hadn't been seen virtually during his lifetime. And so he starts the article by giving thanks to God for being able to live long enough to witness these phenomena. So that period of the Maunder Minimum, as I say, correlates with the last really cold period. And when we're talking cold, I can tell you that 1683, known as the year of the Great Frost in England, and in that year there was 3 feet of ice on the Thames River in London, England. And of course, the most recent warming that has gone on has been since that time. And also, by the way, interesting historically is that cold period correlates with the fur trade and the demand for furs in Europe. But that's another historical social aspect of climate change.
And the implications of this are that if the sunspot cycle, the solar magnetic cycle, is tied to temperatures, which it seems now to be proven. Not only do we show a correlation with these things, but we also now have a causal mechanism, which is the cosmic radiation.
Right.
It would seem that based on the fact that the sun seems to be the principal driver of our climate system and our temperature in particular, the climate's getting colder. And even as we prepare with our politicians, et cetera, for global warming. So this could be kind of a double whammy in terms of impacts on society, don't you think?
Well, absolutely, and of course, this is part of the thing that it's interesting because, as you know, there's no denying now. I mean, I remember when the temperature after 1998, which was a peak year because of El Nino, and it dropped down in 2000. Well, they immediately said, "Well, though, this is simply because 1998 was so high," but since 2000, it continued to decline, and so they can no longer deny it, and of course, with that cooling. The response was, oh, well, this is due to warming. Well, that was so illogical that even people that didn't understand the science were able to say, well, hang on a minute. And yet, as you say, yes, the politicians continue to prepare for cooling. I've done a lot of talks with farmers recently, because in Canada, particularly Western Canada and the Western U.S. this summer has been very cold. In fact, in Canada, Alberta, where I was just recently, they didn't even get the crop in until the middle of June. And I was talking to a fellow just today who lives in Canmore, Alberta, outside of Banff, and he said in the higher ground, they had snow just the other day, and he said none of the older people could remember that occurring. And so, of course, as this cooling occurs, it will make the public realize just how wrong this what's been going on. But of course the difficulty is to get the politicians to realize that, and then of course what strategies do you come with to deal with the cooling, particularly when the public are going to be saying, well, you know, you told us it was warming, now you're telling us it's cooling, we don't believe you, you know, we don't believe any of it. By the way, I tease some of the extreme environmentalists and say, look, you know, if we're preparing for warming and we have to suddenly and rapidly adapt for cooling, the only hope is genetically modified plants. But, of course, they don't want to hear about that either. So,
yeah, and, of course, as you mentioned earlier, cooling has more devastating effects on people's health and on many organisms, not just humans. I think you said in the last interview that in England, for instance, the ratio of deaths between cooling and overcooling, shall we say, too cold or too hot, is about 5 to 1. So more people are killed under cold conditions than under extreme hot conditions.
Oh, and exactly. And of course, one of the things that went on back in 1970 was that through the World Meteorological Organization, they did cold climate scenarios. And one particular guy by the name of Martin Parry, who was originally out of the University of Birmingham in England and then went to the World Meteorological Organization in Geneva, did a lot of studies on the impact of the cooling. The CIA produced two reports that I'm aware of on the impact of cooling and the failure of harvests and the whole social unrest that would occur from that. And Canada, for example, you cool global temperatures by 1 degree Celsius, or which is about 1.4, 1.5 Fahrenheit, half of Canada is out of agricultural production, and so the implications of that are quite profound.
When you're saying CIA, are you meaning the intelligence agency, or is this a different agency?
No, the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency.
Why would they want do that?
Well, of course, the CIA, they're constantly producing scenarios, and we talked about those earlier, but they have to be prepared for any contingency. I mean, one of the things that happens, as you know, in today's world is they'll suddenly say, well, here's a secret report that the CIA did. Well, these agencies are constantly having to look at all possibilities and be prepared, really, for a lot of different things. And so the CIA were looking at the fact that the scientific consensus was cooling and that this was going to continue. And so what they were looking at was how this would affect world food production, and then what that would do to, because we know that when the world food supplies or national food supplies are in trouble, that's the one thing that will trigger revolution. People will tolerate incredibly bad government, but when the food prices start to soar, then they really get very uptight. And so this was just part of what the CIA would be doing.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating, and I really appreciate you you hanging in there, Dr. Ball. This interview has been as informative and as interesting as the one we did in May. And I just, as a kind of a closing comment, I'd like to remind people that they can listen to these interviews that we've done with Dr. Ball on Melody's archive site, and that is what, Melody,
www.givemetrutruth.info,
that's it.
Right.
And then go to the archives and look under Dr. Tim Ball. And if they want to hear these interviews and also read a summary of the interviews with even some nice figures that we've talked about, they can go to my website, which is http://naturalclimatechange.googlepages.com.
All right, I will put a link.
Home.
I'll put a link from my website on there. So that
yeah, maybe that would be a good idea. But anyway, these have been fascinating, and I'm looking forward to writing a summary of our interview tonight because, well, you have a tremendous wealth of important information regarding this problem. And since this has all become very politicized, it's a fascinating combination of science and politics, and it forces us to look at both realms.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. And one thing I think that we could possibly talk about in the future is one of the questions that people ask me is, well, how do you know what the temperature was 100,000 years ago? And I think we need to look at the paleoclimate and the reconstructions of climate and tree rings and how valid are these things and what is the source of this information? Not to get too academic or scientific about it, but talk about it in general terms that the public can understand. And I think that would be a very important part of it.
Yeah, I would look forward to another interview like that, Melody. What do you think?
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd just like to kind of point out is what you kind of came home to me is that you've got politics running science and that we need to start asking questions and holding feet to the fire when we start coming up with this data and where did it come from and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah, absolutely. Yes, and of course that's the question that I get asked. I give a presentation and then the people say, well, yeah, okay, now I start to see. But then the question comes, what's the motive? And we talked a little bit about that tonight with Mars Strong and the CO2 and so on. And I'm always leery about this because I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I prefer to call it a cabal. Cabal is actually an acronym. It's the initials of five very powerful English lords who were plotting to overthrow and, you know, a whole new political agenda. And that's essentially what's been going on here.
And it's not a theory if it's got based on facts.
Yeah.
And
well,
so,
yeah, Vaclav Klaus, who is the prime minister of,
the Czech Republic.
Czech Republic, yeah, and also head of the European Union, has said that environmentalism is the new communism. And this then would be a way to force changes upon society, which would in fact result in the pooring of society and perhaps the shredding of important documents like the Constitution. It would appear that the environmental movement, to some extent, with the global warming issue at the spear tip, has been hijacked by a political agenda, and I think we need to look at that political agenda. I think cabal is a good word for it, too.
And if you think back to the statement you read from the Club of Rome about, you know, these are the perfect vehicles to achieve their end, that really says it all. And of course, the sad thing is that we really do need environment, and we need to care about the environment. But to exploit it the way they have, I think, is really reprehensible.
And I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming on and then staying over since we had a few little hiccups there. But and I enjoyed this, and I hope, you know, we do this again.
Lovely. Thank you, Melody, and thank you, Eric, and thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, great to talk to you again, Dr. Ball, hopefully we'll talk again fairly soon because this, as we outlined, there are important things that we still can discuss here.
Right.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.